This is part two of our interview on TCS Legends with Dwart De Silva. If you missed episode one, do go check it out. You can find it at techcentral.co.za. Now, on with the interview. But we have other companies and people to talk about, so let's move on to talk about Rumanus, who's a character I've met a few times back in the 1990s, but never knew as well as Jeremy and the boys. I think you knew him more intimately than I ever did.
He was a very secretive guy.
Quite secretive, quite conservative. What was his background? How did he... I mean, I know that his success was bringing in Hitachi mainframes to compete with IBM, which was the dominant player in the mainframe business in the 1990s. And those Hitachi mainframes became... I think Hitachi... This became the most successful market for Hitachi mainframes outside of Japan, if I'm not mistaken. That's all Rumanus is doing. Was he always an IT guy or did he come from industry?
So, yeah, he was always an IT guy. So he actually founded a company called Percy Tech.
Persitec, I remember that.
Okay, so Persitec, and then he sold. He had and this was, you know, probably 1990. So he had a violent criminal incident, and he sold his business to Barlow's.
Barlow's, that's right, yes.
And bailed out and said, no, and he emigrated. And in early 1993, 94, he came back. And, you know, again, this is second hand, sure. But I do believe the story.
Long time ago.
He went back. All the information, Barlow's was going through a process of unbundling. Mm-hmm. And I was the Barlow's analyst, so I went through that process. Okay. A guy named Warren Kluler was driving the process. And they had spun out a business called Roynet, which I also covered. And Roynet, the whole aspiration was that Roynet was going to take over the IT assets because it made sense. You know, they would take over Percy Tech and potentially even ISG, which was the IBM.
Yes. It was also listed at the time.
It wasn't listed
not
yet.
That yeah, time, yeah, but it became a listed company.
It became listed. Mm. So then IBM didn't still, you know, now 1994 came along. IBM was now part of ISG and they didn't want to go to Roynet, but Percy Tech was going to be bought by Roynet.
Yes.
So Rumanus apparently knocked on Warren's door and says, you know, I've just read the contract and I've just realized that the Hitachi distribution contract that exists was never signed in the name of Percy Tech. It was signed in my personal name. But, you know, I want to solve this for you. I'd like to buy a 25%. Of the business, because I could never understand. I mean, when I was an analyst, I found this out years later. When I was an analyst, I couldn't understand why Barlow's had sold it on a soft loan basis. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like it was a BE consortium, and even it wasn't really a big thing in those days. Yeah. So the Alfa Romeo Lima consortium, which is Rumanus and his management team, bought back 25% of Barlow's for essentially a soft loan. Now, why would Barlow's do that? Because they loved Rumanus. Well, they didn't love him that much for a while, but actually landed up being the best decision they ever did. Because when I analyzed Barlow's, 50% of their market cap was the 25% that they had in Persitec. So Roo took over the business. Thank you very much. And that's but you
was Persitec listed at that point?
Persitec was not listed. I don't think.
Listed
as Persitec.
Okay.
And so Rumanus' background and actually Pete Den Boer and a number of, there was kind of the English side of the, which was the Dimension Datas, the SBLs and those guys. And there were the more traditional Afrikaans businesses, and they came out of the old military Infotel.
Right.
So that was there where the deep expertise. So Pete Den Boer and Rumanus. Actually, the competition between those two was actually a hell of a lot more than between Jeremy and they really truly just didn't see eye to eye. And if you know Pet, you would have understood why. So Roo set up that business, but Roo, when he set up that originally Persitec, he did land up with 50% market share, which was the highest in the world that the Hitachi had. Mm. And the reason being twofold. One, he had a service policy. Because he loved aeroplanes, he owned Lanseria Airport, and he promised that,
as you do.
as one does. And I think that was his hobby, and ExecuJets he founded ExecuJets. The reason why he did that, well, besides his passion for flying, was that he could guarantee that any mainframe that went down anywhere in the country, he would have spare parts and serviced within 24 hours. Now, you can do that in one of two ways. You can have a division in every town, or you can just fly in the people as he did. And they had the best track record, the best SLA contractual arrangement with government. So any government, IBM could sell, but they couldn't sell to the government entities. Reumanus was unencumbered by any of that because Hitachi really didn't care. Mm. So that was built as a traditional mainframe business. So they came from, Dimension Data came from, you know, kind of the PC world. Persatel came into existence from the mainframe world.
Fascinating. IBM mainframes much more expensive than the Hitachi mainframes? And
it wasn't really a pricing issue, it was just availability. And you know what, in those days,
it was the sanctions era.
The sanctions era, but also, you know, it was just the same way that David Kahn started business. You know, if you're an executive of a bank, you know, and you can buy an IBM PC like I did for 5,000 Rand in 1985, or you've got a Taiwanese knockoff that costs 500 Rand, the risk to you is that you're going to get fired if something goes wrong with that. The reality is that it was actually most good equipment was good equipment. Mm-hmm. So IBM just basically rode on their name.
And ISG became ISM, if I remember correctly.
That's right.
Before IBM decided to reinvest.
And I was and actually that was the gorilla, the listed gorilla. It had a market cap of nearly 2 billion rand. It had, it was extraordinary, and I nearly got Merrill Lynch sued by IBM.
How?
Well, I got the financial director drunk one night, as one does, you know. And he told me that actually he was very concerned, a German guy, and he said he was very concerned that IBM was shipping faulty equipment in containers. It would arrive rusty and unusable in South Africa.
Okay.
And instead of sending it back, ISM would take the write-off in South Africa. I said, but they're 50% externally owned. And he shrugged, you know, and took another drink. I said, but that's theft. He shrugged and took another drink. So I took my non-compliance email and I wrote this. I remember we went far out for that. I wrote at 3 o'clock in the morning, I wrote this email saying, you know, this is what these guys are doing. I said, you know, and unbeknown to me, a dear fund manager who had a very large stake sent it to the CEO, a gentleman by the name of Sal Fasso.
I remember Sal.
And so I arrive at the office. I get called in by either an American boss and a South African boss. I get called in. I say, it's time for a bonus. And pardon the French, you can edit it out. My boss, Jeff Humber, says, we've got a real shit sandwich. We're going to all take a bite. So what are you talking about? So we're going to go and apologize. I said, for what? And they said, look at this email that you sent. How did you get that? So my boss said, he said, you know, he was called into a meeting and he said, he arrives, there's 20 lawyers around the table. And he gets this letter sent across to him, and he says he just wanted he knew the worst part of this meeting was that that he was going to have to look up. He's going to hate me for mentioning this. And he says, it's going to kill me. So I went to the meeting, and they said, we demand you retract this. So I said, look, I apologize if you took any personal affront, because I think I called them a crook. So I said, I do apologize. I said, it was completely out of I said, and we want you to retract this other part. I said, I won't retract that. My boss goes, oh. And there's the CFO. I can see he's sweating because he thinks I'm going to spoil them. I said, if you can show me that I'm wrong, I will retract. Otherwise, I'm not retracting. So the lawyers all went out. They came back 5 minutes and said, we accept your apology. And then Sal Fasso was promoted to head up IBM in Siberia.
I remember Sal Fasso. He was a heck of a character.
No, he was actually.
He was a great character.
But my first trip to Merrill Lynch in New York, you know, I'm walking in the corridors and I could see people whispering. I thought, ah, you know, people are saying, there's the number one South African IT analyst. Meanwhile, they're saying, there's the guy nearly got us sued by IBM.
Classic story. So, Roo, Versatel, extremely successful in the 1990s. I remember they were vying with Dimension Data for a number of years for the company with the largest market cap. I think they were vying on profit and revenue as well to see who was the biggest IT company in the...
Yeah, there was some moron who decided to promote valuing these companies on something called the PEG ratio.
Okay. Was that you?
Yeah, that was me. And so profits of this year were not that relevant. You had to look far in the future and use the compound, your estimated compound growth rate. So a 50 PE was quite reasonable in those days. But they, at the time, they each had about a market cap between 30 and 35 billion.
That's right.
And that's when they went into these discussions to try and create an Uber, pardon the pun, but an Uber Cisco distributor.
Yes.
And initially it started as one thing, it started as a merger, then it went on to an acquisition. And eventually it was agreed that Dimension Data would actually buy Versatel's networking business.
What year was that?
That would have been probably 99.
Okay. Yeah.
The reason I picked up, I wasn't an analyst. Mm-hmm. I was looking at the newspaper and I saw that ExecuJet had just ordered, you know, a couple of $100 million of new aeroplanes. So I found Roo and I said, "You're selling, aren't you?" And he said, "How do you know that?" I said, "I just seen this." He said, "I'll meet for coffee," and he did. And he said, "You now will be the single biggest shareholder in Dimension Data." You know, more than Jeremy, because Jeremy actually didn't really ever have in those days.
He
owned like a couple of percent.
Okay.
You know, his shares used to come to, he used to sell them. You know, it was very disciplined there. So Roo would have been the single biggest shareholder in Dimension Data if it kept his shares.
Right.
And he said, "Don't worry, I'm not keeping my shares."
Interesting. Fascinating. And good time to sell, actually, in hindsight.
Well, and then I think he retired after that. And then Rion Duplessis took over.
But he went to run ExecuJet full time, didn't he?
He slowly went over to Botswana, where he retired. Mm. I've heard he's come back. I believe his wife passed away, Rumanus must be in his 80s.
Yeah. I was trying to track him down. It might be difficult, but might be possible.
It would be great to get him.
It would be great to get him on the show if we can. We'll try. So was Roo there when Versatel bought QData, or did that happen afterwards?
He did that. That was part of the bulking up. Mm-hmm. Someone might have told them that there was a control structure because if you recall, QData was 47% owned by Soltec,
right,
which was controlled by Grintech, which was controlled by Greenica, which was controlled by AVI. So there's a control structure in there. So someone might have highlighted to one of the corporate finance guys like Rion Duplessis that you don't need to do a friendly deal.
Oh, right. Just go in. Was it a hostile acquisition?
It absolutely was.
It was. Okay. I'd forgotten that.
It absolutely was. And who says that you can't be hostile in South Africa?
Wow, I didn't follow that closely at the time. I think my colleague at the FM, Marina Beadley, you probably remember her.
Sure, I remember Beadley.
Yeah, she covered that story at the time. So it was hostile. So Pete can't have taken that very well.
Well, he left. Mm-hmm. He left and then he started a company called Brainware.
He was ousted, wasn't he?
He was ousted.
There was Etienne Fury.
That's right.
And others on
Leon
the board.
Leon van der Bijl.
Yeah, they engineered his exit.
Yes. Mm. So
speaking to him, he was incensed.
I personally don't recall having a meeting with Pitt where he was sober.
Yes,
he'd have this dustbin lid, a big ashtray, which he just smoked.
He did
just smoked, and he has passed away, which is, I guess,
of liver failure, I believe.
Yeah, sadly, no surprise. Yeah. Look, he was not a stupid man, but he was an absolute control freak, and QData's techniques and style. Mm. Was not Roo Monitor's style. They certainly weren't going to cohabitate. So that deal gave because Versatel started to become two things, you know, a local business and an international business. The QData acquisition basically made Versatel maybe even bigger than Dimension Data in South mm-hmm. Africa, and then the international. And eventually, after the disposal of the networking business, they bought a business called Comparex.
Yes.
Comparex was actually the German business that was the agent for Hitachi. What I discovered is that Roo never bought Hitachi directly. He bought it from this company called Comparex.
Ah.
And Comparex were the Hitachi distributors so he bought that company.
Okay.
And then after he retired, Rion Duplessis took over and, you know, again, a long history.
Rion was the FD.
He was the he never worked as the FD. He was the the acquisitions. He was the M&A guy.
Oh, I see.
So okay. He was an incredibly clever guy, mm-hmm. very clever. But when there was some corporate action against Comparex in the early 2000s, and I know because J&J was and my team was supposed to become the preferential partner of Comparex in South Africa, it was never really aired at the board meeting because an Investec-led shareholder revolt resulted in the bust-up of Comparex.
Yes.
So Rion basically and his team bought the international businesses.
Yes.
And the local businesses were merged with Business Connection Group, and the twins took over that business, which then eventually was sold to Telkom.
And the name changed so many times. It went from Versatel to,
Persitec, Versatel, PQ Holdings.
PQ Africa was a subsidiary, was
PQ,
it?
PQ, then it became Comparex.
Oh, was it Comparex after PQ?
Comparex, yeah, okay. Comparex. Then Comparex became CPX. BCX.
And then they brought in the Morpeth Lynette twins. And
yeah, well, Business Connection was actually their business.
Yes.
So they were. They basically merged the business and the twins basically did a great job of running that business.
And there was a guy called Peter Watt who was running the business for a couple of years.
So Peter Watt, myself, first met at another company that we're going to discuss, which was the Altron Group.
Yes.
So he was the CEO of Altron. When I started my career, I nearly finished my career on the same
day. Was he CEO or CFO at Altron?
He was the CEO. Bill was the chairman, and a guy named Tom Sayers, who then went to Nampak, was the CFO.
Okay.
So I got John fired inadvertently because of my report, but that's how I met Peter Watt. And then Peter, post that, then actually ran Comparex for the South African leg when Rion was running the overseas.
Okay. That's right. And it was on Peter Watt's watch that the Business Connection deal then happened.
Correct. And Peter did go into retirement in any case. Okay. He was a good executive, mm-hmm. actually.
And then, of course, another legend who I didn't mention at the beginning of the show, Sipho Maseko, engineered the acquisition of Business Connection, and it still sits within Telkom today.
Yep.
Now just called BCX.
Yeah, Sipho did a great job at Telkom.
He did.
And I think was sorely missed thereafter.
Yes, indeed. But interesting bit of history. Is there anything else on Versatel we haven't spoken about? Any characters in there that we haven't mentioned?
No, I don't think so. I think it was the Roo Marnitz show. And I do still believe that maybe Mark Shuttleworth aside, he's probably the guy who made most of the money.
Okay.
In IT. So yeah. Jeremy didn't have a big personal holding, again, because he was a captain. Yes. You know, his team all had the equity. And Jeremy also, interestingly, I found out that, you know, he had this policy, and when share options came due, he sold them.
Okay.
And I said, you know, it's not a good signal. I said, you know what? I spend all my day, all my efforts. My salary is here. I have 100% exposure. Increasing my exposure is not quality risk management.
Mm-hmm.
So it's when it comes due, I sell. And you know that consistency was actually, I think, an important aspect that was great evidence when he was accused of front running and selling his shares before the crash.
Right.
So, when questioned, I was told, you know, this behavior was consistent throughout. You know, so you can't accuse a man of being an idiot for selling early for 15 years and the one time, you know, where the share price went down and he behaved in exactly the same way throughout that entire course and suggest that that was unusual behavior.
Mm. Nothing if not consistent.
Yeah.
Bill Fenter. We could do a whole show on this particular topic, I think, on his own. A lot of the stuff that Bill did was before my time. Before yours too, actually. He's retired now, of course, living in the south of France, I believe. He must be well into his 80s, if not his 90s by now.
He's at least mid-80s, and I believe he's not very well. Mm-hmm. So it's just but an absolute legend. What an absolute character, but a real entrepreneur, and really... funnily enough, when I first did my IT report and the combined market cap of all the companies was 2 billion rand, my boss took me aside and said, this is very nice. Actually, stop wasting your time and do a report on a decent company like Altron or Ronet. Which I said, listen, do me a favor. I said, this will be a hobby.
Mm-hmm.
I'll focus on those because I know that's where the money will be made for us. So, but trust me on this. Yeah, yeah, fine, but I don't want to, you know. So I kind of gave myself a double job, but that is how I made acquaintance with Dr. Fenter.
Yeah,
because he complained that finally Davis Borkum had an electronics sector analyst, and he was writing these rubbish reports on these silly little companies where it was the report. So I said okay, Actually, that report was what basically made my career, writing the first report on Altec.
Okay, on Altec. Was Craig Fenter running it back then?
No, he wasn't. Craig was employed in the business because Bill put his kids through the mill.
Yeah.
The CEO was a guy named Peter Wilson.
Okay.
And so I went and analyzed the business, and I did my report, and of course, just completely new to that industry, and I didn't really understand the hidden rules and, you know, the genteel nature of stockbroking. Like, we were sponsoring brokers for 50% of the companies. I didn't realize that Davis Borkum here was proverbially known as the buy broker because they never had a sell. And of course, my first report, unfortunately, came out as a sell.
That must have pleased him, no end.
Oh, it was designed. The problem is they were putting all their eggs into the electronic detonator business. And this was Bull's, you know, passion. I mean, they'd invested literally billions in today's money in that project. And it was interesting because at the time there were 180,000 detonations a day. And if you sell a detonator, you know, it explodes. Mm-hmm. So, you know.
Buy another one.
But another one. The problem is, you know, the mining industry doesn't really adapt to new tech. Mm. So you had the whole thing right. So I went through this, and actually, firstly, I didn't believe their projections.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, they took great insult to this. So we went through this process, so, you know, and eventually I worked something out. Their pricing was wrong.
Ah.
So, and they had to be wrong because otherwise the mines wouldn't buy it. But for what a mine would only take supply if Altron could guarantee that they had 3 months of stock in their storerooms at any one point in time. So the more you sold, the more you had to keep in stock. Mm. So based on the interest rates at the time and et cetera, I worked out the more detonators you sold, the less valuable the company was. So eventually we disagreed. So they insisted on a sensitivity analysis, and the sensitivity analysis went to 45,000 detonators a day. So here was the nuance in the report that only people reading understood.
Mm-hmm.
I had the best case scenario, the company was worth whatever it was. I think it was the share before the split. I said the share is worth, let's use an index number of 100 rand if they sell 40 on the best case scenario. On the worst case scenario, they're only going to sell 15,000 detonators a day and the share's worth 125 rand. So what I was saying is this is really a bad project.
Mm.
So I knew that this was a big problem. So in those days, and I had the report, I engaged with the executives. I put exactly what they said, and I said, and I paraphrased them. And I said, I've done everything you asked me to do. So said, I know, but you're not changing my opinion. Jeez, you know. I said, but, you know, Bill's on holiday. He's going to want to read this. I said, in those days, you needed permission.
Yeah.
So I said to John, I said, can you put in a letter that I have delivered everything that you asked and that you're releasing this? He says, you know, I'm going to get into trouble for this. Is it true? Yes, it is. I said, then please put in a letter. So he put it in a letter. They took that letter, went back to the office, and I made our printing department print through the night. 4 o'clock in the morning, I was there, and I sent the couriers. I was in my office at 5 o'clock in the morning, and Bill Fenter phoned. This report is not to go out. I said, so sorry. It's already gone out. I said, but I didn't sign off on it. I said, I've got a letter here that says that I'm allowed to sign. I said, I'm so sorry, Dr. Fenter. I said, but, you know, if your left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing, it's not my fault.
Oh, my. But did he send tanks to your house?
I actually had not met him. And I remember the results were a week later, and they had the war museum. And I walked in, and he walked up to me, and he had this, like, squeaky voice. He says, I expected to meet someone with tail and horns. And I said, oh, I expected someone younger. So he laughed, and you know what? 6 months later, he called me into a meeting, and he said, you know what? I hated you, but I've read your report. Your forecasts are better than our budgets. The problem you identified is absolutely true. I said, I fired Peter Wilson. I said, John's not with us anymore as well, because, you know, I said, you know, that's not really fair. And I said, well, he didn't pick up this working capital problem. I said, it's not because of your report. I said, you know what? I've worked out. I said, I'd rather have you on my side than not on my side. And from that day onwards, he would include me in budget meetings, in forecasting meetings. So I had such an advantage relative to my competitors, because I was in every meeting. If there was a presentation, I'd be the MC. And so we really became very, very close. I mean, I went to his 65th birthday. You know, he really treated me as an absolute insider and never had anything else. In fact, he asked me to interview Craig and say, you know, I fired Peter Wilson. Do you think I should? I want you to tell me honestly if Craig should be the next CEO. And I said, you know what? Everyone's expecting it. Just do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so that's the first time I met Craig. Craig. And, you know, I don't know if his father said that he had to impress me, but he was nervous for the meeting. And, you know, we got on well and went, I said, listen, you know what? The guy's energetic. He's smart. He knows the business. Give him a shot.
Yeah.
And so Craig became the first CEO.
Fascinating.
I'm sure it wasn't my recommendation. I'm sure it was going to be done anyway.
I've heard some amazing stories about Bill Fenter over the years, but one that keeps recurring, and I don't know if you know the story here, it was certainly before my time covering the sector. I think it was around the 86 or 87 time frame. But there was a business called Punchline Computers, founded by a guy called Barry Schechter, who I never met. There was a massive falling out, I believe, between Barry Schechter and Bill Fenter over some deal to do with PCs. I forget the stories now. Do you know what happened there?
I do.
What is the story?
So Bill bought Punchline, mm-hmm. Barry Schechter.
PC business.
So it was a PC business, and it was basically the first Incredible Connection.
Okay.
And they had a store. You could go and buy, you know, Lotus 1-2-3 or whatever it was.
Okay.
And you know, they'd have a shrink wrap, and you know, and so, but it was focused on the PC side of the business,
right.
And you know, and Bill was prescient enough to know he's got to get into this market. And this company called Punchline was doing incredibly well. It was before my time.
Mm-hmm.
And I did meet Barry Schechter, who had a different story completely. So I'm going to tell you Bill Fenter's side of the story. And Bill says, you know, they did the due diligence, and said when they actually took ownership of the business, they went and looked through all these boxes of software that they bought, and 3/4 of the boxes were empty.
Oh.
Don't know if that's true or not,
mm-hmm.
you know, but that's what he claims. Mm-hmm. The other thing he said, this business's numbers were fraudulently delivered. You know, they would book revenue before the year end to a particular client who happens to be a friend. You know, post year end, it would get reversed,
mm-hmm.
But they wouldn't correct the earnings. I mean, that nonsense happens all the time. So,
yes, it's happened to other tech companies subsequently.
It's still happening.
Yeah.
You know, so So the question, is, you know, is it true or not? You know, Barry Schechter got on his horse and went to San Diego. Mm-hmm. Years later, Softline wanted to put Barry on the board, and I said, you know, good luck. And they said, yeah, no, but he was never found guilty of it. I said, yeah, good luck. I said, what do you mean? Why don't you meet Barry Schechter? I said, I'm not interested. I said, why? I said, well, because if he was guilty, he's a crook. And if he was innocent, he's an idiot, because he should have stayed behind and defended himself. Mm. I said, either way, I don't think you should. I said, you do what you want. And they did put him on the board. Mm-hmm. I did meet him, and I found him quite an engaging, clever guy. But I don't know if the facts were right. But, you know, and it was in the sanctions era. And he said, look, I wanted to get out of here. That's the reason I sold my business. I was always going to emigrate, and I wasn't going to hang around and throw mud and actually use up my firepower for what I really wanted to do, is take my family overseas.
Okay, interesting. Interesting. So Bill eventually stepped down and handed the reins to one of his sons, Robbie, who ran the business for many years. It always astonished me how Robbie and Craig are two very different people. Robbie was much more, how would I describe this, more conservative, more almost level-headed, I guess. Craig was more rah-rah, let's do it, gung-ho, out there, had a very different management style, probably rubbed up a lot of people the wrong way over the years, actually, because I believe his management style was quite aggressive. What do you think of the way the sons managed the business post his kind of exiting and slowly stepping down as leader of Ultron?
I had a great relationship with both of them, and as you say, a completely different style. Mm. But, you know, in fact, on Bill's 65th, I had my artist do a picture of the South Fork Dallas, and I had, Ultron in the background instead of South Fork, and then I had this Mercedes M-Class, you know, with the two boys and their tennis rackets, because they were both professional tennis players.
Yes.
And these two girls on the bonnet. and I actually framed it and I gave it to him. And, you know, to his credit, Bill absolutely loved it and put it in his study. I stopped watching TV when I became an analyst, because, you know, I had a series. I mean, this family, the dynamics of the family were absolutely incredible. Mm-hmm. And because I was on the inside, mm-hmm. You could see so much. So, both driven, mm-hmm. both really actually, I mean, the father really inculcated their ambition. And I think, you know, probably broke them, because they actually tried too hard, both of them. Mm. Craig in particular. I mean, Craig actually didn't have a life. I think Robbie had a bit more balance. Mm. And I think, his wife probably gave him a bit more balance, whereas Craig was 100% about work.
Yes.
And and all he wanted to do was please Dad.
Yes.
Which is, lovely and sad.
I believe he was bitterly disappointed when he wasn't chosen as the successor.
Yeah, he was, but I think more is made of that story than it really was.
Okay.
You know, he didn't get the opportunity, but, you know, we kind of doubled his efforts, I think, then
at
Altec. Mm. And you know what? In any company, you get the good times and the bad times.
Sure.
And, you know, there are lots of reasons why Ultron started to trade at a deeper and deeper discount.
Yeah.
There are lots of reasons why the value was trapped. And one of the biggest issues was the control structure, the control shares. Remember, they had the N shares, and people didn't like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, a lot of the business was driven out of parastatals. And so all of this played a factor. So everyone forgets about all the good things that they actually did over 10, 15 years before, you know, the reins were truly handed over outside of the family. Mteto was appointed by Anthony Ball. The control of the business was handed over to Anthony Ball.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what people don't understand. Mm-hmm. You know, Anthony got a stake, but the control was never really given up. Mm-hmm. It was just extended.
He was looking
after the family's interests, and he could rely on the trust that's still, I'm not sure how much they own, but it's probably still 25 or 35.
Well, they've been buying more shares. Well, Value Capital Partners has been buying up more shares.
Yeah, I mean, they've done an incredible job of unlocking value.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, the business today led by Werner Kapp, a true outsider to the business. I mean, he
also Nexstar Data.
Exactly. He grew up in Dimension Data.
Yeah.
And became their CEO briefly before heading over to Ultron. But there's so much history to the Ultron Group, ups and downs, that it's impossible to chronicle it in a short podcast episode.
And they fought with everybody. I mean, very litigious. I mean, Bill used to get very upset when I went to go see Tony Farrow because they had a huge lawsuit over prepaid meters. Spescom really actually invented the prepaid meter, which Bill claimed to have invented. So I don't know who's right. But so they had a big lawsuit. I mean, I hated the Roynet guys because they were eating his lunch. You know, and Bill was completely and totally adaptable. I mean, in the 80s, you know, had photographs of Bill with the ruling nationalist party at hunting parties. You know, I blinked and I went into his office in the 90s, and you know, there is at the charity event with Madiba, and you know, and he was a completely adapter. He was a true business. He was driven by business.
Unlike actually Piet den Boer at QData, who didn't adapt to the new South Africa.
No, not at all. Mm. No, not at all.
Actually, I think actively found the new South Africa quite disappointing in some ways.
Well, and having said that, he was found guilty of smuggling Krugerrands in the 80s out of South Africa.
Piet den Boer was?
Yep.
Oh, wow. I'd never heard that story before.
So, you know, people wear whatever hat they want. I mean, Bull was unashamedly commercial.
Yes.
And, you know, and as you said, you know, things change, you know, perspectives change, you know, in order to do things, you've got to think in different ways. So he adapted seamlessly.
Yes, yes. So Duarte, another name which we're actually going to add to the list. We started the show with five names, but there's one extra name we're going to touch on just briefly because he was so critical to this listed era back in the 1990s, and that's Ivan Epstein, the founder of Softline, which I think a company many people have actually forgotten. They're now, I think they were bought out by Sage, if I'm not mistaken, and now part of the listed Sage group, which I think is listed in the UK. But Ivan was also quite a character from back in the 1990s. Not someone I engaged with a huge amount. How did he get his start in business, and what was the importance of Softline in the tech industry in those days?
So the business was founded by him and his brother-in-law, Steve Cohen, and they were both chartered accountants, and hence they got into the software business. And a guy named Gerald Rubenstein, if you remember, the Rubenstein family, was the chairman of the business. So they created an IT business, and I, in fact, Davis Borkham here actually did the listing. They actually did a reverse listing through a cash shell called Benoni. And they relisted into Benoni, and what they did is they put in some IT assets. I was not particularly complimentary because of the company at the start, because they had eight divisions ranging from PCs to, you know, mid-range computers to software. It was a hodgepodge, and I wrote a report as the sponsoring broker, and of course they expected it to be a positive report in those days, and I said, just a loose aggregation of IT assets lumped together to create critical mass was the opening line.
Oh, dear.
So Gerald went to Mr. Humphrey Borkham of the time and threw his toys out the cot, legitimately, because I was an insufferable brat. And Humphrey came to speak to me, and I immediately resigned, saying, you know, you go list your crap. You know, I'm not going, you know, and off I went, and I stormed off, and I reported him to Merrill Lynch, who instantly told him, listen, just please, you're never allowed to talk to Duarte Silva about his research again, because this is like... And, you know, I think back at this because, you know, Humphrey's a wonderful man. He was chairman of the JSE, and I still speak to him. And I wouldn't be speaking to me if I'd behaved in that way. Just, you know, it just speaks to what a genteel person he was, because I was impossible. But my report went out, and all my clients knew something because, you know, in those days, you know, you had to get permission, and the compliance isn't what it is today. If there was a Latin title, it meant sell. Mm-hmm. So my first Altec report, the title of the report was Tempus Omnia Revelat. Didn't matter what it said under there because it said market minus or hold. It was irrelevant. My clients knew because I telephonically conveyed that automatically means sell. Ignore what it says on the report. And my softline report started off with the sell. But they worked so hard to get me on their side, and they engaged, and they discussed. And, you know, I didn't change my view throughout until when Siltec started to look at its operations, and HP pulled out of the country, and Siltec's biggest asset was QData, and Rumonitz basically bought that. The opportunity came to buy the best local grown accounting package called Pastel. A guy named Ivan Ferrer was the founder of the business and actually a joint venture to Siltec, and they managed to buy that, and that basically made them a player in the software arena, and the rest is history. Mm-hmm. You know, the business grew, they sold to Sage, and Ivan was and his team were incredibly successful and made a lot of money.
Did he stick around after the Sage acquisition?
He stayed. He was a senior exec at Sage for quite some time. I lost track of him, and I believe now he's basically a deal maker has got a stake in quite a number of businesses, including some in South Africa.
Okay. Well, we must try and get him on this show, either for season one or season two. Be interesting to chat about that era with Ivan Epstein. But back to our list, and Jens Montanana, interesting guy as well. He founded Datatec, I think, around 1993, 94, also around the turn of, around the first Democratic election. And listed that business on the JSE pretty promptly and has subsequently built a global IT empire, still, funnily enough, listed on the JSE with a secondary listing, I think it is, in London still. Or that, I think they may have terminated that listing a few years ago, now that I remember that. But Jens, an interesting character, British. I think he was referred to for many years as the governor, not sure why. tell us a bit about Jens and your engagements with him.
Yeah, I wasn't that close to the Datatec crowd. They listed, and when they listed with a market cap of 50 million rand.
Right.
And all they had were they simply were a U.S. robotics business.
That's right. I think
U.S. robotics modems.
Yes,
remember the old...
Yes, I bought my first modem from Jens Montanana.
That's right.
It was a U.S. robotics
company. And I looked at them and said, what is this rubbish? Yeah. And then Jens started to do what everyone else started to buy.
Yes.
And, you know, he obviously had an eye for it. Mm-hmm. But the real turnaround for Jens, and I'm probably going to get someone else into trouble, was at the time, Dimension Data was flying high. Mm. Datatec was a minion in many regards. And, of course, they subsequently did very well. And actually, some of their team members, you know, like Donna Bass went on to found Front Range and was a list. There was the guy who ran Verizon. You know, they had some really good executives, and they started to occupy some interesting spaces. Mm-hmm. But the real turnaround for that business was actually the institutions. Mm-hmm. I'm going to avoid using which they were, but there was an institution that came to me and said, you know, well, it wasn't my idea. They came and explained it to me. I said, you know what? Dimension Data, through the MIT structure, is controlled by Sanlam. You know, we're a large institution and we have no anchor IT investment. We've decided this is going to be our anchor investment. And so we think that this guy is a solid guy. We're going to support him. We're going to back him. But we're going to back him a little bit more than just... you know, vote in favor. Mm-hmm. And what they did, and I can't verify it, but the actions would suggest that this was correct. Mm-hmm. They pre-approved transactions that he was going to say, you can go and you can negotiate, knowing that we will either support the issue of shares, mm-hmm. or we will actually provide the cash. We're effectively underwriting. I said, obviously, we always reserve the right. I said, but we are supporting you and we're backing you. And that institution landed up owning a significant stake so that they could actually have a position in the IT space. Great strategy. Worked for Jens, and Jens didn't disappoint in terms of what he did. But they were modem people.
Yes, originally.
But you know, he demonstrated his ability. And actually, you know what? After all is said and done, guess which company still exists and still has a name
and other
Datacroft
and Datatech.
Dimension Datatech. Yeah. You know, Dimension Data's gone, Versatel's gone. But so you've got to did something right.
Yeah.
But they never quite made the headlines like the others.
They didn't, but they've certainly had the longevity, and I think they were worth at one stage more than Dimension Data in terms of their market cap.
Well, I think when Dimension Data collapsed, maybe Spacecom was valued more than Datatech.
True. but Jens, a very private sort of guy. He never. We don't know much about him. He's always kind of worked behind the scenes. British national. I think he lives in the UK now. For some reason, still listed in Johannesburg. I don't quite understand why, because most of their business is actually abroad. Every 6 months, he's reporting to investors here in Johannesburg. Why do you think Datatech keeps its Joburg listing?
You know, why do people go to Australia? You know, because you'll see lots of reasons, you know, because of the synergies, because of this, because of that. It's because the executive either wants to live there or has got some attachment. And, you know, there is business here. And, you know, I guess it's a recognition of, you know, giving something back. So I think it's great. I think it's supportive. And I think, you know, long may it last. But actually, Datatech was probably, of all of them, probably the only, besides Front Range, the only other company that made a success of the US.
Yes, yes. And
so that, you know, there was talent there.
Yeah, and they made some very smart acquisitions, some of it using expensive paper.
Which they all did, you know. You know, in hindsight, you know, issuing paper on a high multiple to buy a paper sounds trite, but Pitt got it wrong. EOH eventually got it wrong. You know, at the end of the day, if you play the game to the extreme, it's a Ponzi scheme.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, interesting. Asher Bobot, of course, is another interesting character who...
I suspect you won't get Asher on the show.
No, I don't think so. You've certainly fallen from grace. But Jens, interesting guy, and he's still around, still reporting every 6 months and still running that business successfully. And by all accounts, it's been very rewarding for shareholders, even in recent years.
And they had a good chairman. It was Gary Merola. And I was also a real gentleman.
Yeah.
And
another legend in the sector.
Yeah.
And Datacentrics.
Yep.
Then our final name on the list today, Duart, is definitely a legend in the sector. Alan Lott Craig, effectively the founder of Vodacom. He started his career at Telkom and was, I think, tasked with some of his team members at Telkom with investigating the mobile opportunity. And he realized, to his credit, very early on at Telkom, that this was potentially massive and that he wanted to run with it and lead with it. And run and lead with it he did. And he built South Africa's most successful mobile operator. Have you, I know you weren't as close to him as some of the guys in the IT sector. What are your views, though, on Alan Lott Craig and his achievements?
I actually met him a few times through Dr. Paul Fenter, because Ultron was a big supplier, and I also had some interactions with him subsequent, you know, in my McCarthy Bank days. So, incredible guy. I mean, very focused, very smart, and, you know, in hindsight, it looks obvious that cell phones were going to predominate.
It wasn't obvious then.
The J curve, you know, you looked at those old J curves and the analysts who used to look after these things, and you look at MTN was a disaster. There was a guy named, was it John Beck?
Yes.
That ran, I mean, unsuccessful. I mean, they had to have a number of takes, you know, in terms of the CEO to get someone. Whereas Alan took the helm of that business and basically drove it through the J curve into the high profitability domain. And so I met him a couple of times. He was through Bull. And in fact, you know, at one of Bull's birthday parties, you know, it was literally, we'd go to the birthday party, it was the two sons, the daughter, myself and Alan that were invited. And, you know, I was the one always spilling water over Alan's wife. But so he just was absolutely solid. But, you know, and essentially created, as you say, the monolith that Vodacom is, to his credit. Mm-hmm. I did take him in the 2000s when it was clear that we were not going to hold on to our banking license. Mm-hmm. I went to Alan and I said, you know what? I've got an idea. I said, I've got an idea that airtime is just electronic money. And I said, and I, on that basis, I think that you should buy our banking license. And he says, you know what? I'm really tired. I said, you know, let me explain something. I said, when I put up a mast and my payback is about 13 minutes on these things, I said, I have a much better business than a bank. I'm not interested. And I thought, well, okay. I then went to Paul Edwards at MTN and I nearly sold him a bank. the only reason he didn't buy us because he thought it would affect his relationship with the banks. And I said, let me tell you something. I think that you're going to be bigger than the banks. I said, so, but there are some limitations on cell phone companies becoming banks in the white, you know, so that I wasn't aware of at the time, but you could always, you could have got around those through structure. Mm-hmm. And so Alan knew what he had. He had a, he had created, he had gone through the rough times, he had invested CapEx, he'd built an infrastructure, and he had a cash generating machine.
Indeed, indeed. And there were some, you know, you write about MTN though, there were some real characters who went through that business as well. John Becker went on to found USCO later.
Correct, USCO. Yes, listed USCO.
Listed USCO, yes. And yeah, they were around for a few years. And of course, there was, you mentioned Paul Edwards who went on to, I think, run Jonic, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right.
And then, of course, there was Patuma and Klerko who did amazing things for MTN.
Amazing things.
He transformed that business into what it is today.
Yeah.
Incredible. He may be worth trying to get on the show as well, actually, if he'll do it. I know he's still actively involved in business, but not Craig. He was a maverick as well, which made him interesting. He wasn't one of these sort of cardboard cutout businessmen who, you've been tasked by Telkom to build this division that looks after mobile. He took Vodacom and he built it into something that wasn't Telkom at all. In fact, he seemed to rather disdain Telkom after a while, even though this business was incubated inside of Telkom.
Yeah.
He went on and eventually ended up fighting tooth and nail with people like Tom Barry, who was seconded here as chief operating officer of Telkom from SBC as part of the privatization in the late 1990s. And I remember those two characters did not see eye to eye at all. And I remember Not Craig actually kind of played off the Vodafone and Telkom shareholders because they were earned 50-50 at the time, and neither of them had control of Vodacom, which suited Alan or Craig right perfectly because he could play Vodacom.
You forget one part of that structure. It was, there was 12.5% owned by Remgro.
Oh, Remgro.
And Remgro was the deciding factor.
That's right.
Telkom at 50%, Vodafone at 37.5%, and Remgro at 12.5%.
That's right.
Remgro offered the 12.5% to Telkom. They said, it's too expensive. What they didn't realize is by saying no, they handed control away to Vodafone, which probably actually was the best thing for Vodacom.
Yes.
And Telkom should never have unbundled it because that should have, and they should have been happier that this was the, was instead of going and forming yet another Telco network. Mm. But that's history. So
that was one of the biggest mistakes in corporate South Africa was Telkom selling Vodacom. Back in the day.
Well, as I said, all boiled down to that 12.5% because if that 12, they would have been quite happy because they thought they had deemed control. Mm-hmm. But the 12.5% carried the control.
Yes.
And who played whom against in that transaction? But, the incumbents of the state were the guys who really messed up because even though Telkom was... Was it listed already? It was probably listed, but it was controlled. It was essentially a state-owned controlled entity.
Yeah.
And I think it boiled down to what I heard was just, that's just ridiculous because they didn't understand the control premium.
Mm-hmm. And there were, of course, Alan or Craig led various initiatives, including the investment in Nigeria, which was in response to MTN, which ended up going pear-shaped, and they had to pull out of their Nigerian operation. A lot of stories over the years about how Vodacom built their business, which we're not going to go into.
But what Alan understood is he understood he had to try things.
Yes.
But he also understood not to bet the shop.
Yes.
whereas MTN bet the shop in Nigeria. Mm. It has worked from time to time.
Yes.
Until the Nigerians decide they need a capital raise.
Yes.
If you sit as a shareholder, I think there's a deeper sense of comfort if you sit in Vodacom and in MTN. Mm. And just by virtue, things have changed. Then I think Patuma definitely changed that profile completely. Mm.
But I remember attending all of the Vodacom results presentations at the Voda World precinct in Midrand, and even before that when they had their offices in Sandton. And you could always tell that Alan McCraig was very passionate about this industry, and he loved to play the game. And those presentations were he would say things off the cuff, and it would get him into all sorts of trouble.
But he had such a handle on the detail.
He did.
And that's really, I think, what you need when you're going through the J curve of death.
Yes, yes. But I remember he used not to mince his words. He didn't actually give a damn. He was the salt of the earth.
That's a typical South African, they'd call the spade an effing shovel.
But I remember his views clearly. I was sitting in the front row in one of those Voda World auditoriums, and he got up on the stage, and Rika had just been announced, the SIM card registration thing, and he thought this was the worst idea ever.
The thing that everyone ignores.
Exactly. He was right. But he got up and another CEO might get up and say, and be very cautious because this is a government initiative and policy that's been introduced. He didn't care. He got up on stage and said, Rika's rubbish. It's not going to work. Scrap it now. It's garbage. Those were not his exact words, obviously, but that was the way he communicated it. It's rubbish. It's not going to work. And he was always... He just shot from the hip, and I think he was great for that.
Reminds me a little bit of Stephen Kosoff.
Okay.
A different style of communicating, and then I think Stephen uses more four-lettered expletives, but Stephen is also direct like that. And it's refreshing because,
it is refreshing.
They're not mincing their words, they're not being political, they're direct. They're sending a message, and that's a guy that you always knew where you stood, and with Alan, you always knew where you stood.
Yeah. And of course, his health, he had some terrible health issues, which eventually caught up with him. He had several heart attacks. I think his first major heart attack was, might have been his first, but he certainly had a major heart attack while he was exercising in the gym at Vodacom.
So that's where I met him. I met him soon after he recovered after the first heart attack.
Okay.
And I actually thought, he was tired. Another comment was, I'm generating cash. Mm-hmm. And I think, it was soon after that they started to play much more of a passive role.
Okay.
And then just obviously suffered, the ill health that eventually, took him from us.
Yeah. And then eventually he made what everyone in the industry thinks is a terrible mistake. He accepted a job to go and turn around Cell C, and may have unfortunately been the thing that that did him in. Very stressful. We've seen how much stress it's put on the guys at Blue Label trying to turn this thing around. He went in there, I guess, perhaps a little bit of arrogance, thought, look at the wonderful job I did at Vodacom. Why can't I do it again here at Cell C? And he couldn't. And he had another heart attack. And we had a stroke, I think.
Yes, that's right.
And that forced him out. And he's unfortunately suffered from ill health since. And what do you think it is about CEOs who, they've been so successful, yet they feel they've got to come back and try again? Why? What do you think it's in the character makeup of a CEO that like Alan McCraig, that couldn't convince him to retire quietly?
You know what? You live your life on the edge, the adrenaline, the excitement, the stimulation. And also, let's face it, people who respect you, who you engage with, and all of a sudden you wake up one day and it's gone. And, having sold my business, on the one side you're relaxed, and you wake up in the morning, but, one day you wake up and you're not on the trading floor, or you're not on the, and you say, gee, I miss this.
Mm.
And people like that love to bolt. And, we've sadly seen the demise of Mr. Eric Ellerin.
Mm.
And there's someone I was very close to, and he's backed a lot of IT ventures in the past.
Yeah.
And himself.
Blue Label.
That was Blue Label, and others. But, as an you get these people that they're incredible in their own right. And actually, you know, what makes them live to a good old age is being active.
Yeah.
And yeah. the stimulation and the desire. And also, you know, at the end of the day, it's not about building a legacy so much. In some instances it is, but it's also about, you know, creating something of value.
Mm-hmm.
So there is that. And then the other part of it is they love the game.
Mm-hmm. Can't give it up.
Yeah.
Well, there's certainly been some real mavericks in this industry over the years, Dwight. No doubt we're missing dozens of names of people who have done incredible things in the sector. And, you are one of the legends in the space. And I thank you so much for sharing your incredible insights and stories about some incredible people who've done amazing things in the tech industry in South Africa. So thank you for making the time and sharing your wonderful stories and insights with the Tech Central audience today. Much appreciated.
Thank you, Duncan. It's been a privilege to be associated with all these people.